Take a network break, grab a virtual donut, and join us for our weekly analysis of all things technical. Today, we're going to be talking about zero trust access, misleading 5G ads, security vulnerabilities, and space networking. We're supported today in part by Service Express. Lower your post-warranty support costs, take control of your hardware refresh cycle, and extend the life of your server, storage, and network equipment. Visit serviceexpress.com/packetpushers, and while you're there, learn how you can win a $100 Amazon gift card. Also, join the Packet Pushers team and Appneta for a live virtual breakfast or brunch or wherever it is you're signing in from on November 10th, where we'll discuss how to tackle your biggest hurdles to ensure network performance. Sign up for that at appneta.com/pplive. That's appneta.com/pplive. Stay tuned for after the news. We've got a Tech Bytes podcast with Apstra. We're going to dive into Apstra's integration between Apstra's AOS data center automation platform and the Sonic Enterprise distribution. That's a Dell-supported version of the open-source Sonic Network OS. And last but not least, Greg, you are launching a new podcast called Heavy Strategy.
Yeah. In this show, we talk a lot about strategic and analysis issues related to IT infrastructure and enterprise IT infrastructure space. But I've always felt there was an opportunity to go deeper, but we can't do it in this format because the idea is to cover a lot of topics relatively quickly. So it's news.
Yeah.
And I recently was chatting to Keith Townsend and, we did a couple of shows ago. He was guesting with us to talk about the VMworld event. And we've decided we're going to get together once a week and publish a podcast called Heavy Strategy. And the idea is 15 to 30 minutes max with one topic discussed deeply from a strategic point of view. Now, Keith, of course, is more of a IT consultant, strategic consultant, business consultant, and so forth. And I'm coming more from the analysis side of the technology. So it's sort of going to be a bit of a business versus technology vibe. So we'll publish the first show next week, Heavy Strategy. It won't be in some of the Packet Pushers feed, so you may likely have to subscribe to it separately. But, get ready for it. Could be interesting, and it might be the sort of thing you want to listen to.
I think that's going to be fun. I know you have very strong opinions. Keith has spent a long time in the corporate trenches, so he's bringing a very experienced perspective. Mm. So it should be a good show. I'm curious to...
And it's intended to be antagonistic, because Keith and I do rub against each other a little bit. We do have different points of view. We're both willing to express them strongly, but also to, loosely held and to be convinced by each other's arguments. And that's kind of the premise of the show, is that it should be, combative to some way or debating to, not hostile.
No,
but,
definitely not hostile.
You're so clever. That's great. the sort of stuff that you get at most events these days where everybody congratulates themselves for being standing on stage sort of thing.
Yes. If he thinks you've said something foolish, he'll let you know, but you can still shake hands afterwards and be friends.
Well, we've got to front up next week and do a show. So
that's right. No burning bridges.
Yeah, that's right. You got to be a little bit careful.
All right. So keep an ear out for Heavy Strategy. We'll be promoting it across all of our channels, and it should be fun. Let's dive in. First, we've got a follow-up. This is actually to a recent Heavy Networking episode where we talked about the risks of disaggregation, white box, and network OSs, a la Broadcom Cumulus. We've also been talking about it on the network break, so I thought it was apropos to bring it up here. First, the listener said that maybe we had missed the whole point of disaggregation in that if your ASIC supplier starts playing games, we were saying that was bad news for Cumulus and Cumulus users. But part of the notion of disaggregation is we'll just swap out the hardware, keep the OS, and bring in an ASIC platform that will work with the network OS of your choice.
And I agree with that, and I think he's making a good point here in that I was actually focusing on the damage, not the rebuilding. So if you're running a corporate site and, the answer is yes, you can keep Cumulus. And on reflection, Mellanox is certainly going to be out there talking to Cumulus customers saying, why don't you take those Broadcom switches and retire them early and we'll give you these Mellanox switches to replace them with. And that is certainly, what Cumulus is going to be doing now that they've lost access to the Broadcom ASICs. But I think what I was also trying to focus on here was that Broadcom is trying to maintain control, very strong control, of what its customers are doing with the product as it brings it to market, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And sort of strong-arming Cumulus, who was leveraging Broadcom's feature set to act in a certain way. Now, that's perfectly legitimate business behavior, and the IT industry is absolutely rife with that. Look at Cisco's way that it controls resellers in its marketplace. You know, its so-called partners are more like little puppets that are allowed this and allowed to do that and not allowed to do this and not allowed to do that.
And we also know that Oracle moves with a very heavy hand, even with its own customers. So, yeah, it is tried and true.
Yes, and goes around them and talks directly to customers, even though a reseller or a middleman might be involved and so on and so forth. It is a very difficult issue. And in technology in particular, because of the access to analytics and the tracking and the surveillance that's possible, there's a whole lot more that happens that we don't, that it's much more policeable than it is, if you're shipping tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a tomato grower, you can't exactly say, I don't want my tomatoes in, Sainsbury's, for example, because you've got no say over that and you can't measure it and you can't whatever. Mm-hmm. So it is an interesting debate. And I think I was more focused on that angle, the sort of the fact that chips have to be made by these very large companies or seemingly need to be made by well-resourced, huge companies who can then use that position to try and control the full supply chain. And I think also the other side here is if you were just using Cumulus as an operating system, yeah, you could switch to something else, change to another open source operating system. But really, Cumulus is the only one with commercial support. Dell Sonic has come out. Sonic is a little ways away from reaching mature stage. We did a podcast this week talking about Sonic, and it's with Dave Maltz from Microsoft, who leads the Sonic project from within Microsoft. So keep an ear out for that. It'll be around in November if you want to hear more about Sonic and how that project is working out. But it's just the wrong time, really, for enterprises to take a hit, and it sort of undermines the whole white box thing was the other thing I was looking at. So he does make a point. You can switch the operating system, you can switch the hardware, but at the same time, this is, just when white box was starting to get traction, it sort of seems to have been nipped in the bud.
Yeah, I think my take is, I think he's absolutely right. A part of the whole purpose of disaggregation was, if you like a network OS or a hardware platform better, you can move it. And if you've leaned heavily into features in Cumulus, operationally to take whatever advantage of whatever features they have and you like Cumulus, maybe you're willing to take the risk of moving to another ASIC platform. I think the problem with that is, one, I think it's harder to swap out switches than it is servers. He used an example of, Intel versus AMD. The other is, generally, corporations don't like risk. And so having to say, well, we really like Cumulus, but we need to get off this, widely accepted ASIC platform, the higher ups may be like, oh, I don't know, can we just do something else? So, yeah, I think he makes a good point, but it is not great for the industry. Although he also says maybe that Broadcom's MuscleFlex, which used to work in the past, may not have as much of an impact in a disaggregation age.
I think that's possible, but I also think the real issue here is that companies like Cisco and Juniper have worked really hard not to give Broadcom a dominant position. Cisco in particular, it's developed its own silicon when it probably didn't, arguably part of the reason that it developed is because it's Cisco and it wants to build its own silicon. But I bet part of the business logic was, we don't want to be dependent on other companies for our silicon, or we don't want to be 100% dependent on Broadcom, for example. We want to have multiple suppliers, and hence why Innovium Silicon is there, Marvell Silicon is in there, Cisco's got its own silicon, it's got the cloud scale ASIC, and now the Silicon One stuff. And I think a lot of the existing companies that supply into the networking business don't want to be Intel'd. They don't want to become dependent on Intel like Microsoft did, or HPE and Dell got caught having to do business with Intel at the long term.
Yep, absolutely. So thank you to the listener for reaching out. If you've got comments, corrections, clarifications, hit us up, packetpushers.net/FU. We'd love to hear from you. All right, let's dive into some news. First, Cloudflare has announced a new enterprise networking and security offering. It combines zero trust network access with cloud-based security services. Components include a client for laptops and mobile devices, controlled SaaS access, next-gen firewall and IDS service, and integration with third-party ID management systems, including Okta, Ping, and Active Directory.
So it was about 6 months ago that Cloudflare announced that it was providing a sort of a VPN where you can access websites inside of your enterprise network by using their network as a tunnel, but it was only for websites. And they've obviously started with that, iterated rapidly. But what they've done here is deployed a fairly comprehensive VPN solution. So the concept here is that your VPN connects to their edge nodes in their network. Obviously, if you run a CDN, you've got compute nodes all around the globe. So now you install a client, you run into their CDN. Once you're in the CDN, you can start to do a whole bunch of things. You can do firewalling, intrusion detection. You can route, you can modify the traffic flow to path so that it's optimal. You can cache it, obviously, in a whole range of different things. And also the third-party identity management is a nice touch. I would have thought surprising to see them come out with that in the first place. Most times we see VPN sort of come out and then they try and sell it for a while before they bolt on the identity management. So maybe they already had that feature somewhere else inside their suite and they're just able to plug it in. But I think it's a good move from them.
I also think it's a good move. I mean, this is the right time if you're going to come out with a new zero trust network access solution, because folks may be open to the notion of rethinking their VPN, their remote access strategy. I think, though, for Cloudflare, it may be, I'm curious to see how they're going to push this. Like, are they going to hire enterprise sales teams? How are they going to get this in front of enterprise vendors who might not be thinking of Cloudflare for remote access?
Yeah, it is interesting. Hard to see that Cloudflare can sort of break in. Like, we talked last week about Juniper's VPN, and companies would talk to them. And when you talk to people who are hosting VPNs and in the remote at work era or the emergence of distributed work, most people are still doing the same old thing that we've always done, you know, the traditional VPN client from a traditional vendor to a VPN concentrator. And we'll talk more about, you know, Cisco's just released new products to support that for customers. We'll talk about that in a little bit later in the show. But I wonder how many companies will actually say, oh yeah, Cloudflare is a VPN company. That'll be great. You know, right. if I'm a developer, you know, or if I'm a small agency, you know, with flexible ideas, but where's the resellers here? Where's the technical experts who actually do the advice? Where's the sales channel is basically what I'm saying.
Right.
So it's one thing to have a product. It's quite another to actually get sales on.
Especially when you've already, if you're trying to break into an account where maybe it's Palo Alto or Fortinet or Checkpoint or Cisco or Juniper or whoever who's already got muscle there. So it's great that Cloudflare, I think, is moving into this space. It's an opportunity for folks to take another look at remote access. But Cloudflare, I think, has a hard road ahead.
And also they're going to end up competing with SD-WAN companies. Mm-hmm. Well, some form of SD-WAN, and there's also a whole market for software-defined perimeter. This is sort of in that space. You know, we've been doing podcasts with companies like NetMotion, yeah, talking about their software-defined perimeter.
Zscaler, and Ariaka, Cato, so many others.
So many others. And, you know, what sets this one apart? And, I mean, I have to put out my usual thing. Cloudflare continues to be a supporter of extremist organizations. They provide DDoS protection and CDN services to anybody who's willing to register that in. And they claim that freedom of speech is important. And this includes some of the most ugly parts of the internet are actually protected by Cloudflare. And several human rights organizations are now actively calling out Cloudflare as an extremist organization itself because of its support for these websites. So while Cloudflare might be delivering good services, please do think twice as to whether you would support a company that does that sort of thing.
An additional complication for Cloudflare in trying to land an enterprise client who may be worried about its own personal brand.
Yes, you don't want to have your corporate brand associated with someone who actively supports fashion. You know, yeah. Any sort of extremist. Let's not pull it left, right, indifferent, whatever. It's just extremists is what they support. Yeah.
All right. Well, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Service Express. Don't let the OEM swipe your IT budget. If buying new data center hardware isn't an option, consider third-party maintenance. You can lower your support costs, extend the life of your equipment, and save your IT budget. Refresh your service, not your hardware. Key features of Service Express include real-time hardware issue alerts, automated ticketing, 30-minute engineer callback, dedicated local primary and secondary engineers, and a 97% first-trip repair success rate. And here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can head on over to serviceexpress.com/packetpushers, learn how you can win a $100 Amazon gift card. That's serviceexpress.com/packetpushers. We thank them for being a sponsor. But jumping back to the news, SonicWall, you know them, they make firewalls, VPNs, and other gear. They've announced a serious vulnerability that affects nearly 800,000 VPN appliances. It's a software bug in their OS. It was discovered by Tripwire. Apparently, it can be accessed remotely over the WAN, can cause service denials, it can crash devices, and possibly be used for remote execution.
This is just a quick community service announcement because this is pretty dire. Anybody who's using SonicWalls for an SSL VPN, and as of the date that of today, apparently that's nearly 800,000 of you. As the report from Tripwire says, an unskilled attacker can use this flaw to cause a persistent denial of service condition. The flaw exists pre-authentication and within the SSL VPN component, which is typically exposed to the public internet. So this is a pretty horrendous...
Not good.
So there's a, right about now, there is 800,000 firewalls which are vulnerability to a unskilled attacker to cause a persistent outage on your SonicWall firewall.
Which is targeting remote access. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's right. So you know what you need to do, obviously. There have been a patch has been issued. The fix is in place, but you have to need to go and activate it because there is hundreds and hundreds and thousands of firewalls which are now vulnerable.
All right, links in the show notes to the patch. Otherwise, go look it up and get patching. Moving on, a Dutch telco has signed a 5-year deal with Ericsson to provide the equipment for its core 5G network. This is despite the fact that its 4G network is Huawei. The Register has a story on this, and it says that just last November, the telco, quote, picked Huawei to replace existing Ericsson RAN equipment across the country. So I guess this Dutch telco is doubling down with Ericsson for 5G, but sticking with Huawei for 4G.
Yeah, it's fairly easy to sort of draw... The spying accusations leveled against Huawei and the anti-China rhetoric that's going on. And you would have to say that that's certainly part of it. But if I was the Dutch telco, if I was KPN as well, I might have as well used Huawei as a stalking horse to get a better price out of Ericsson. So it's never just one thing.
Yes.
And I think also if you've bought Huawei 4G and discovered that perhaps, I've always maintained that the Huawei equipment is immature. The software quality is not there. The internal organization is not as well structured and able to produce high quality goods as its competitors. So, you might say that Ericsson and Nokia are certainly not bug free by any stretch of the imagination. They're pretty good at making, comically bad products, but Huawei is far worse. I think it's just as likely that KPN went, this Huawei 4G stuff wasn't all that great. The experience wasn't that great. We're going to go with Ericsson this time and lean into that, even though it's going to cost a bit more. It might be operationally cheaper to with the lessons learned.
Yeah, that's possible. And I brought this up because Huawei is persona non grata here in the United States, but it seems like in Europe they've taken a more nuanced approach to dealing with Huawei. So this is...
Well, I think the U.S. approach to confront this, to be combatively and aggressively public about their hostility to Chinese companies is probably counterproductive from a business point of view. It's absolutely politically the right thing to do, perhaps. The elected government there is the one that's taking the position. But if you're a company, you probably don't, and you've got a 4G network that's being managed by that company, you don't want to go hostile and start calling them names.
Uh-huh.
Because they're going to go like, okay, see ya. And, which is what's happening, I believe, to some of the telcos in the US. There's many billions of dollars of Huawei equipment was deployed throughout some of the telco networks in the US. And Huawei's basically been forced to pull out of the country, and the support is pretty bad now. So maybe they're sort of taking a more realistic way and saying, let's just ease out of this gradually.
Yeah.
Which would be smart.
I mean, I would love to have been in some of those board meetings with KPN to find out if they were leveraging Huawei as a stalking horse to get a lower price.
Which is never one thing.
Yeah.
It's usually, it's always multiple things. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, moving on. Ars Technica has a really good story about Verizon pulling a slate of advertisements for its 5G network. They were aimed at firefighters and first responders. Apparently, T-Mobile challenged the ads with the National Advertising Division of the Better Business Bureau. That's a watchdog group that promotes truth in advertising. I guess Verizon pulled the ads before NAD, the National Advertising Division, could actually analyze the veracity of the claims being made. So that may be a tell there.
The point about 5G is that you will never see it outside of the cities in the next 5 years. It's just the way that the radio spectrum works is that most of the features of 5G that promise greater throughput, lower latency, are all using higher frequency spectrum, 3.5 gigs, 5 gigahertz, 6 gigahertz, things like that. And it requires phones with that, and when you run them, but the distance is just so low. You're talking 100 meters for those sorts of features. If you're in a rural setting, like out in the countryside, well, even in the suburbs, those features aren't going to be useful. There's a number of articles coming out of China this week where various politicians and even the CEO of Huawei is basically saying that the Chinese 5G rollout is a waste of time in its current form. They're having to deploy 4 to 10 times as many base stations because of that maximum distance of the signal. Apparently, the current generation of technology uses 4 times the amount of power of the old 4G network. There's so few handsets that actually run 5G that they actually switch them off for 12 hours a day.
So, wow.
Because nobody's using them, and the phones just fall back to 4G. Mm-hmm. So the 5G hype is really, really out there. There's nothing in, and I will come back to my point, there's nothing in 5G for the consumer, you and me, Drew.
Right.
Your handset at 4G works pretty well. There's some, you know, it would be nice to have more bandwidth, but the world's not going to end. You can still watch Netflix. You can still play computer games, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But the real use case that we'll see emerging will be machine to machine. So this is where your IoT devices. You know, I think in the future today you get an IoT device and it comes into your home and then you connect it to the Wi-Fi. There's another generation of devices, probably not for the home, but for commercial applications. You ship them out, you plug them in, they run off a battery. The battery will last 5 years. They connect directly to the 5G network. They're pre-configured and they need nothing. And all of a sudden they start sending surveillance data back to head office. So the example we talked about in the heavy strategy with Keith, because we covered this issue this week, was imagine a refrigerator with a tray and it's got sandwiches on it. And every time someone picks up a sandwich, the tray knows when the sandwich was picked up. So ham and salad was sold, you know, whatever it is. And it can report back. So they know how many sandwiches are at the store, how many to make, you know, what time of day the sandwiches are being, you know, maybe if you knew that the sandwiches were all bought in the morning, you should have an early delivery to that store. But if, on the other hand, people are buying them all at lunchtime, you could do a late delivery just in time for lunch or something like that.
I totally understand that, you know, the value of this kind of monitoring, but to hear you describe sandwich tracking as a primary use case for 5G just sort of deflates that whole 5G hype so wonderfully.
Yeah. I think the point here is that, and the point I would make is that 5G is really about the carriers, the mobile companies, moving to use software to control their network. So replacing all their old routers with new routers that are API-driven, replacing the software in the base stations with stuff that uses hypervisors and containers so that they get away from custom hardware, you know, appliances that were hard to maintain. And they also move to software-defined radio. And now all of that is software-controlled, and that's a radical change in cost. You can cheapen it. You can reduce the cost of running that business. But the telcos are trying to get you to pay for that upgrade. Mm-hmm. Instead of giving you the discount from the reduced operational cost. And so far, that's not flying, and that is probably right. So keep up the good work, consumers. Don't listen to the telcos.
Yes, yes. We've been reporting for years, it feels like, on overstated wireless claims around 5G, carriers saying they have 5G when they actually aren't, that kind of thing. So let's remember what Public Enemy advised us many decades ago. Don't believe the hype.
That's right. And we really need to wait for 5GNR, which is the 5G new release.
Boy.
They're so imaginative in that organization. And that is still 2 or 3 years away before we'll have the technologies that will actually do any sort of transformation. So, you know, don't buy a phone for 5G. Don't buy routers that have 5G. You're just not going to get anything out of them for a substantial period of time, is the general rule. General rule.
Anyway, a link to the Ars Technica story if you want to read all the gory details. It's very well done. Quick break to tell you about AppNeta. You can join the Packet Pushers team and AppNeta on November 10th. We're having a virtual breakfast, brunch, or dinner, or late night snack, depending on when you're logging in. We're going to discuss how to tackle your biggest hurdles to ensuring network performance. Topics include remote worker visibility, ensuring performance of voice, video, and collaboration tools, multi-cloud and direct internet connectivity, VPN management, tool consolidation. You're going to hear from some smart folks at AppNeta and from the Packet Pushers. You can register for this at appneta.com/pplive today. Set your calendar for November 10th at 11 a.m. Eastern U.S. We'll bring the virtual donuts.
It's always good fun. I always enjoy these events. We haven't done many of them because we haven't found a way to make them interesting and worthwhile. We did them for a while, but they just basically turned into a webinar. But this one, AppNeta team's actually come to us with some ideas to do things a little bit differently. So we're going to trial those, and maybe it'll be worth your while to attend.
Yep, hope so. Head on over to appneta.com/pplive to register. We'd love to see you there. Right, back to the news. Greg, you picked up a story on Apple support for thread networking. This is a technology that lets low-power IoT devices create mesh networks.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with this. I had to go and look it up, to be fair.
Yeah, I have not heard of thread networking myself, yes.
No, and I was following up on the Apple announcements last week when they announced HomePods. They announced a new mini HomePod, and the documentation specifically called out support for thread networking. And, of course, I went, ooh, hello, what's that? And I went searching for information. There is an industry body called threadgroup.org, which is a stunningly useless website. It really has nothing that would help somebody like me learn what thread networking is. So, first request is anybody who's out there who knows might know something about thread networking. This is a request for help. If you've got some pointers or something like that to links that could tell me a little bit more about it, and maybe we could share those with other people. But basically, the whole site is just like an advertisement for people who support thread networking, with almost nothing about how it works. But here you go. Here's what I think it is. Thread is a low-power IP-based networking technology for connecting Internet of Things devices, offering a secure mesh-based system that makes it easy to build an ecosystem of devices. So it's some sort of IPv6-based protocol allowing mesh, has some features that allow devices to auto-discover and auto-communicate each other. It seems to be specifically targeting the connected home. And it's got support from lots of companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, and so forth and so on. And the websites, as I said, is one big advertisement for the people who are supporting Thread. And you'll find there's lots and lots of socks and boards and cork technologies that proudly proclaim Thread networking support without actually telling you what Thread networking is. So if you know, get in contact. Either hit us up at packetpushers.net/FU or email me directly.
I mean, we know there's a huge market from folks like Amazon, Apple, Google to get devices into consumers' homes so they can surveil them even more closely and also reduce friction on buying products from them. So I guess the easier you can make it to connect these things together, the better for those people. Whether it's good for us remains to be seen.
As is always the way.
All right, moving on. Networking as a service startup Alkira has announced a funding round of $54 million. This is a Series B round. It brings the startup's total investments to $76 million. Alkira provides networking as a service that includes multi-cloud networking with integrated security services. The round, this Series B round, was led by the venture arm of Koch Industries, which also happens to be an Alkira customer.
Yeah, not Coca-Cola, but Koch, K-O-C-H. They kept saying Coke. I thought it was Koch, but...
No, it's Coke. Yeah, they pronounce it.
Coke? The Koch brothers?
Koch brothers.
It's an unfortunate association.
It is.
Probably when they were named Coke, they didn't think of that at the time. I think the interesting part about this is, did we talk a couple of weeks ago about Alkira changing a little bit, like pivoting a little bit away from the multi-cloud networking angle to more of a network backbone as a service angle?
I don't know if we did, but we had that conversation with Alkira in a briefing they gave us, but I don't know if we said anything publicly.
Yeah, so we did got together with the management team at Alkira. They are a sponsor of Packet Pushers, so, you know, disclosure, I suppose. They originally started off as a multi-cloud networking as a way to connect, you know, your on-prem and your off-prem clouds together. And they took the approach that to make that work, you needed to put network functions in the middle. So you have a box in the middle that's instantiated in a VM or a container, and they do all that for you. And all you need to know is that if you configure this, and this. And the story is that they got together with the Koch company, and that company is unique in the sense that it's constantly buying and divesting organizations, and it needs this networking functionality that just comes and goes at a really huge scale. And Alkira was able to give them a solution that did that. And I think they'd like the story basically seems to boil down to that old Remington Shaver ad from 50 years ago. You know, they liked it so much, they bought the company. They didn't buy it, they invested in it, yes. But you get the idea. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I can see why Alkira is touting this, because having a brand name like Koch Industries, which does a lot in the energy sector, is good for a small company trying to get some attention. And this pivot from multi-cloud to a more robust networking as a service with a backbone and all kinds of integrated security capabilities makes sense to me, because while there's a lot of talk about multi-cloud, I don't know how much actual investment from enterprises.
Yeah, well, I've struggled... I think multi-cloud networking is something that most people haven't gotten to yet. in the sense that if you've got multi-clouds, you've probably got a little bit over here in Google, a little bit here in AWS, a little bit in Azure, and you've got your on-prem stuff. And you could probably get by for a while with just hacking through it or making do with whatever.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? You don't actually need to connect these things together. But if you're a company that has, you know, a disparate group of companies that all need to connect together, that has historically been very difficult. You know, NAT gateways, DNS overrides, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. And Alkira has a play in that space where they'll just take a lot of that away from you. They're actually using their network functions virtualization engines, you know, the middle boxes that they put in to figure all those problems out for you and then orchestrate it using a software controller, SDN. They also integrate with Cisco SD-WAN. So if you want to be able to do something with that as well, there's a play. That's because the team from Alkira were in Viptela in the early days. So
yeah, their major pitch is essentially a single operational environment to handle whatever network you need to handle. Do it from one place with one set of controls instead of having to figure out how AWS does it differently from Azure, et cetera. And let them act as that overlay for you, and you have one point of contact to make it all work, which... You know, for a company like Coke, where they're acquiring companies and they've got to spend time, you know, rationalizing private IP address spaces between their company and the new one, and Alkira can just make that go away, which is what they say they can do. Yeah, that there's a lot there.
But here they're not just buying the product; they're actually investing in the organization, right, which suggests that they think there's something there and they want to keep close to that product to make sure it doesn't go away.
All right, let's wrap up with a little bit of space networking. SpaceX has received official approval from the U.S. Federal Communications Commission to bid for federal funding to help provide rural broadband in the United States. The U.S. government setting aside $16 billion in funds to promote broadband development in rural areas, and SpaceX's Starlink satellite broadband service can now compete for a chunk of that money.
Yeah, much to the displeasure of several people, because most people think that SpaceX's Starlink doesn't actually meet the criteria, doesn't have the latency or the throughput. But the awesome power of Elon Musk to, you know, brand Elon seems to have won over the FCC, who wants to give them a chance. And I think the US government is probably right to give support to its space program in this way. Especially, and Starlink does have the potential. However, it's also true that Starlink has made lots of promises, none of which it's managed to deliver on yet. So we'll see.
I mean, there's that, but you also have to counterbalance it with the fact that the United States has been trying to get decent broadband service to rural areas for years and years and years, and none of the ISPs have lived up to their commitments either. So why not be disappointed by Starlink too?
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, government bodies, tendering processes. There is $20 billion in that rural development operational fund, RDOF, and it's a huge political thing. So it is pretty interesting, but, if Starlink can get that sort of money, then they actually have a path to profitability, of course. So the U.S. government will basically be paying to build Starlink is what it comes down to. So don't get the sense that Starlink is a commercial organization. If it takes this funding, it's actually government assisted.
Yeah, well, you know, Elon Musk is good at raising money. So
he's good at getting money out of the U.S. government,
too. Yep, he really is.
That's what SpaceX does, and that's what Tesla does. Apparently, a lot of the funding for Tesla comes from U.S. government funding for green money, for green environmental issues. Yep.
And just on a side note, since we're talking about space networking, in the latest issue of the Human Infrastructure newsletter we put out, I included a link to a really good story in The New Yorker about the dangers of space junk to Earth-orbiting satellites. There is a vast amount of human-made debris in orbit around our planet, and as more satellites are getting boosted into orbit, that not only adds to the debris, but also increases the chance of a potentially catastrophic collision. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, we'll have the link here in the show notes as well. It's a really good story.
Yeah, there was a near collision event last night. Did you?
Oh, I didn't even know that. There you go.
Yeah, huge one. Apparently, I've been following. I have a bunch of Twitter lists that follow space people, and they estimated that the event last night had a potential collision energy of 60 plus or minus 5 gigajoules, or about 14 tons of TNT.
Wow.
The main uncertainty is the mass of the... It's basically, there was two pieces. There was a third stage of a rocket that was launched 20 or 30 years ago, and a Chinese
satellite.
Yeah. And they don't know exactly how much it weighs. They assume it was about 2,000 kilograms or 2 tons. Anyway, this morning they report that there was no indication of collision. They were really concerned because if these two things collided, they thought it would make up to 500 objects, like pieces of space debris. Right. And it was going to be right in the place of a premium orbit. This is like one of the few orbits left above the Earth where there is no space debris. And they're now starting to get concerned that there's so much stuff up there that where our satellites are going to be running into things on a near continuous basis in a few years. Right. So there'll be lots of fun around that.
Oh boy.
Space networking is not actually all that reliable if you sort of think about it from this point of view. So
down on Earth, we've got fiber eating backhoes. Up in space, we may have little pieces of space trash accelerating like bullets in orbit. Lots of fun.
And, you know, like, tell you what, these space tweet people are really, really, they're really in each other's faces. They really argue with each other. And, you know, there's one organization going, no indication of collision. Another one's going, it wasn't even a collision. It wasn't even a chair. They weren't even close. You know, you guys are idiots. It's like, wow, you guys are really getting down.
A lot of passion.
Loads. It's kind of good to see. Good, vibrant discussion.
All right. Well, we got links in the show notes if you're interested in space junk or collisions or whatever. So check it out. Now, please stay tuned for our conversation with Apstra. We're going to be talking about how they integrate the Sonic Enterprise distribution of the Network OS into their AOS data center automation platform. That's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bytes from the Packet Pushers, a 15-minute conversation at the intersection of technology and business. Apstra is our sponsor for today's episode, and we're going to discuss Apstra's support for the Sonic Enterprise distribution. This is a disaggregated network OS. Our guests are Sean Hafiz, he's VP of Product Management, and Jeff Tansura, Head of Networking Strategy from Apstra. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. So first question is, are you seeing enterprises actually adopting Sonic, and if so, why?
I think we should start a bit with history of Sonic. The effort started by Microsoft many years ago, but in 2016 had been contributed to OCP, and this led to massive innovation and increased adoption. So we see that finally the feature set that had been built around Sonic is suitable for enterprises. We see that features like VPN, VXLAN are coming, and this allows common enterprise or Telco DC to deploy Sonic as is, obviously with our help.
Sean. So this transition where Sonic was really came out of Microsoft's cloud efforts and they pushed it into the open source community. And what you're indicating here is that the feature set has now been iterated on, added to, contributed to by traditional enterprise vendors. So Broadcom, Dell, EdgeCore, Mellanox, and so forth. And the point is that Sonic is now enterprise ready.
Yeah, hyperscale feature set is obviously not enterprise. There's a lot of legacy things that the hyperscales don't have to deal with. I mean, the reality is that the hyperscales will be pushing down as far as they can with layer 3. Enterprise still has requirements for layer 2. And so, as you said, companies like Broadcom, Dell, EdgeCore, Mellanox et al. Have really worked to bring this feature set from out of the cloud to the enterprise, and we're working to support their efforts. We're vendor agnostic as a rule, and so for us, supporting more options to the end user is in our DNA.
I think it might be worth just quickly recapping that Apstra is an SDN controller or an SDN application that configures the switches. And in that sense, there's not so much going on. Like, your dependency on Sonic is that it works and does the things that you need it to do, not that it's got a million features per se. Or is there something I'm missing there?
So we have a set of test it reference designs that we've built with the customer that solve 90% of the customer's use cases. And the instantiation of those reference designs within an Apstra AOS control blueprint doesn't care about the underlying hardware. Test and validate the hardware and software NOS combination for the correct features. But for us, it's just a black box in which we push, say, please do this.
That's a unique part about the Apstra solution is you're not highly integrated with the hardware. There is a level of you're supporting both, but unbundling them to make the most of the solution the customer wants.
Yeah, one of the key points about you saying that is that data normalization is really important. So the other thing is that if you're trying to understand what's going on in your network, and in one network you have Cisco, and the other network you have Juniper, and the other network you have Cumulus, and the other network you have Sonic, Arista becomes a problem. And so if you use AOS to manage this, it's completely normalized across the entire set. So from a user standpoint, you can see what's going on and get like-to-like comparisons, even if the underlying hardware is different.
So I think the reason there's enterprise reluctance around the disaggregation model is there are concerns about complexity. How is this going to affect operations? Can I get support? Things like that. Do you guys feel like these concerns are legitimate, and are the benefits of disaggregation compelling enough to overcome them?
Absolutely. So why people want to disaggregate? People want to decouple life cycle of software from hardware, and it's done through SAI interface on Sonic, as well as actually being able to choose the best piece of software they like, which creates complexity and interdependency between different pieces of software and hardware used by Sony. So how are we addressing this? We abstract the differences and, you know, as network engineers, we are used to configuring devices through single interface, being CLI, NetConf, something else, but we expect end-to-end configuration. On Sonic, you have four different files interfaces that you need to use to get something working. So iOS provides single workflow that hides these interdependencies and allows you to focus on services and configuration of services and monitoring and services rather than I need to go into CLI and configure part of FRR and then go to Redis and configure part of VLAN. It's all hidden away by iOS.
That's AOS, the Apps Store operating system that's doing this. The complexities that might exist in Sonic, you're saying you guys with the AOS operating system abstract that away so that it's one interface just as if we were using a traditional integrated OS and hardware platform.
Yeah, absolutely. It hides away this complexity and interaction between different surfaces and subparts of the Sonic ecosystem.
Okay, so if I need to do something in FRR, which is the routing stack inside Sonic, I don't have to worry about going into each Sonic distribution and tweaking it. I do it all from AOS.
Yes. Right. Moreover, if you want to provide reliability, high resiliency, there are some interdependencies, how you save files, how you reload them. And iOS takes care of this very, very high level of resiliency. We ensure that whatever you save, whatever you reload, it's always repeatable and reversible.
I like to push down that, you know, I got my start as a network engineer back in the 90s. And, you know, when you first, you start with the Cisco world, you always did. And then when you sat down at your first Junos box, it was completely different. And the other vendors sort of followed the Cisco model, and all of a sudden Juniper did something different. But it turned out why it was different, there were still enough similarities to provide you some sort of guide to what you're doing, right? Mm. The commands were similar enough. There was a single place to poke. And if you are a user in the enterprise going in cold in the case of Sonic, you've got a problem because you don't know which container or subsystem to poke in order to make sure of what you want.
And that was exactly the question I was going to say, is that Sonic is not a single command line and then you talk to all the apps inside the router. You actually talk to FRR as one app. You talk to the Linux to talk to the interfaces on the switch as another. And if you want to configure ACLs, you'd go over to this part of the operator. All of these are disparate. They're not unified. Each one of those feature sets like FRR is one project and the NOS and the SAI, it's not immediately obvious how to run this. It is something, Sonic is for experienced players in a sense, like but AOS sits over the top and does all that work for me. And I get the advantages of generic hardware, an operating system which has got all the latest features in it, but AOS is actually just taking away all that complexity. And I can spin up to that over time if I wanted to. I don't have to confront that challenge face on. I can sneak up on that and learn a bit at a time.
Yeah. One of the things that's great about this, sorry, let me just say this, is that if you're trying to learn how a new NOS does something and you know how an old NOS does something, in AOS you can build the entire blueprint, select Cisco, select what you know and look at the config, and then switch it to Sonic and look at the config.
Yeah.
Side by side, you can see and you can learn. Mm. You talk about having to poke all these different containers and all these different changes. Within our reference design, within our user design supported reference design, we just make this work and we guarantee that to the end user. And if the end user is interested in peeling back the onion on Sonic and understanding how it works, we have a team of great people and we'll actually spend the time explaining it to the user and teaching the user. It's part of our sort of high touch service that we really just care about making the user's intent a reality.
Let's just take a minute to understand why I would use Sonic instead of something else. Is it just cost, or is it better, or is it what are the functionality from a customer point of view? If I get switches running Sonic, what do I win?
But you could say disaggregation is an abstract term, right? You just move one part away from another. However, here you could choose best hardware with best software. practically, even within software, now you could choose between FRR to Junos to NXAS. There is really thriving ecosystem of vendors on both sides to deliver this. Cost is obvious consideration because it's free.
Mm. The other interesting thing about this is that you end up buying the NOS separate from the hardware. It's like buying Windows or buying a Red Hat license. And so the underlying hardware, you can buy that server from, you know, Fujitsu or HP or Supermicro or whatever white box is the cheapest, right? This is the same thing. You go and you say, is it Delta? Is it Quanta? Is it Mellanox? Is it, you know, is it EdgeCore? Is it one of these box providers that have the ASIC and the feature set that I need to support this? And then you can send it out to bid. And you can just guarantee that it will work, right? It's exactly like you handle your Linux servers today.
Really, really, really useful for larger organizations where you don't just have like 10 or 20 switches, in which case you've got hundreds of switches to support. Having that ability to choose this vendor this quarter and this vendor this quarter, and maybe there are stocking problems. You know, we have supply chain challenges going on in the world. And this ability to use AOS, the Apstra's AOS over the top, and then the actual hardware can be what I've got in my network as I transition for something. That sounds like a possible use case to me.
Absolutely. And if you look, there's a gap when you take someone else's software and someone else's hardware, right? Neither party might have validated the combination. On our side, and we are a completely CI/CD driven company, any change that goes into software being tested millions of times a week, 50,000 times an hour, right? So we take your hardware, we take Sonic, and we run all variety of different tests, all possible scenarios you could use. And some of them are, you know, very, very complex with thousands of endpoints, millions of routes. So we as Apstra validate and guarantee that the combination of software and hardware is going to work for you.
And I'd like to point out, just as an aside, that we use our own software. We have two production networks, a 5-stage and a 3-stage, that contain a version of every vendor as a spine and as a leaf with every operating system. And they are wired together running EVPN and DCI. And, you know, we upgrade that on a regular basis to our latest bleeding edge code. We depend on our own stuff to be able to work.
Eat your own duck food.
Yeah. There is a question that I wanted to ask. If I'm using a different network OS in my environment and I want to bring in Sonic, can I run two different network operating systems under my Apstra umbrella simultaneously? Not on the same device, obviously, but in on different switches, but still under Apstra?
Absolutely.
Yeah. As you go through design process with AOS, you choose hardware very, very late in the process. All the definitions are logical. So you choose switch that has 3,200 gigs. Could be really anything. When you go to apply this configuration, you would choose Sonic or Arista or Cisco or Juniper. May you wish to change it, it's just three clicks away. You change one by another, you recable, you're done.
And I'd like to add here that, you know, the best thing about standards is there are so many to choose from. the reality is, if you look at if you remember the original implementation of MPLS, Cisco and Junos ones, there were some growing pains in interacting. And EVPN is the same way. And so us as a company, we're actually testing these interactions between Cisco and Arista and Juniper and Cumulus and Sonic and all these platforms. And there are various interesting behaviors between their EVPN implementations. And we account for that, and we can tell you what those are, and we can dive down, and we can just make sure it works. This will get better over time, but right now, one of the things that you get is the peace of mind for us that you say, hey, I've got this Cisco network and I have the Sonic thing. Does it work? And we'll look at this and say, yes, it works.
And to give a simple example, to provision ESI multi-homing, it will take you three clicks. It's months of my work making sure everything is working. The last bit, reverse engineering, what different vendors done, how to normalize this data.
That's what I pay you for, Jeff. That's why I buy products from vendors, is because they have done the hard work for me, right?
Yep.
There is absolutely a place for people who go out and get Python and write automation scripts, and 6 months or 12 months into the process, they learn really hard lessons on how hard it is to sustain these things. And I keep saying to people, you need to think carefully about whether you want to maintain that or whether you want to pay somebody to write this automation for you. So, and I'm glad you're in charge of that, and I'm not, right?
Because, and you know what's also important? We provide coherent feature set on the platform from design to deployment to validation, because otherwise you might be using 15 different tools that do different things, and what do you do with it? how do you make it actionable?
I'd like to push down on the thing you said about writing your own stuff. Look, I'm capable of writing my own Ansible playbooks and building a network. And then next day somebody makes a change. What happens, right? Like, do you have, like, are you thinking about doing your own automation in the sense where you're creating your own GitHub repository, your own service tracking, your own change tracking, right? Like doing this for a network yourself is the same thing as doing a software project. And you have to be willing to put in the resources to do it. The great thing about our platform is we're doing it for you. That's our expertise. You should focus on your business and automate the things that are important to your business and not automate things where you can buy an off-the-shelf solution that solves your problem.
That's right. I keep saying to people, you should be running your Python and your Ansible on top of AOS or your SDN, right? And let the SDN do the hard work, and then you're actually delivering the value for minimum effort, because you don't get paid any extra for all that extra work.
It just becomes a giant pile of things to keep track of and technical debt.
So let's have a look at some of the customers. As we prepared for today's show, you brought out a couple of customers that you want to talk about some of the real world experiences.
Yeah, so the one thing I want to say is I can't name customers right now, but we'll give you some idea what they are. So I'm a PM, so I look at the data, right? And the data and a bit of crystal ball view of the future is how we plan what we're doing. What I can tell you is that 75% of our existing customer base is asking us about Sonic for Enterprise and its details, and they're asking us for help about doing POCs. And if I was a betting man, I'd say probably 1/3 of those are actually going to go to production right now that I feel comfortable with. I can tell you that Sonic is driving new customer engagements. People that look for information on Sonic are coming to us, and we're happy to help. And the space of customers is really interesting. So you have the large retail firms for their cloud portals that are looking at this. And then you have the big data processors. They want fast and, most importantly, cost-effective networks. And when you think of this, people miss the reality of who these users really are. You know, you expect the government. You expect technology. But we have real-world instances of oil and gas, funny enough, considering the state of the industry, but they're looking at this, they're using this. We have insurance and banking that are using this, because bringing EVPN solves the banking problem with the legacy L2 apps.
It solves the segmentation problem.
Yes, absolutely. So if we are looking at 5G, there is increasing need for disaggregation. We've got mobile edge computing. We've got disaggregation in RAN. And all of them require packet processing. They all require switching in different form factors. Should be smaller, more cost optimized, more energy optimized. Having single nodes that could run a different piece of hardware but provide same interface, same experience to operationals really helps you to reduce OPEX. So this is another part of customers we're seeing more and more engagements with.
5G would be almost perfect for the Apstra AOS, that idea that you can have a controller sitting on top of a fairly diverse set of hardware. Let's telcos really move forward with that fabric at the edge of their networks.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very good use case.
So if we've piqued your interest, you should go over to apstra.com/packet-pushers to find more. That's apstra.com/packet-pushers if you want to learn more about Apstra AOS and how they're working with Sonic and other network OSs. Thank you, Jeff and Sean, for joining us, and thanks to Apstra for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.